You're listening to CKMS News on CKMS 102.7 FM in Waterloo, Ontario. This program is a part of the Local Journalism Initiative Grant Program and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can access the recordings of the show on radiowaterloo.ca/news or on the National Local Journalism Initiative website, canada-info.ca. I'm your host, Shalaka Jadlov. We'll be picking up the conversation from part one with Crystal Mari, senior curator at the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery, for a two-part series uncovering Deanna Bowen's Black Drones in the Hive. Deanna Bowen's work maps power across the archives to unearth damning narratives on Black survival across Canada and the United States. In continuing our conversation, Crystal will dive into some of the curatorial choices that bring the exhibit to life, the unlikely patternicity that links some of Kitchener's historical characters to themes in the exhibit, and the evolving role of art spaces in supporting collective movements beyond the gallery. In previous interviews, Crystal has spoken about a work by Deanna Bowen titled 1911 Anti-Creek Negro Petition. This work was formerly at KWAG in 2017 for Carry Forward, an exhibit curated by Lisa Myers. We'll kick off the conversation today with Crystal sharing that story with us and expressing how archives perhaps engage visitors in a particularly and unlikely close way.
Yeah, I can share a little bit about that just to retell the story. I mean, it's a story I feel like I've told a lot of times. It's such a good story, so I don't mind telling it again.
It is.
It's an engaging one. It's pretty important to us, too. I know it changed me and the way I think about the kind of work that we do within museums. And, you know, the short-ish version of that is that, you know, we showed the petition back in 2017. It was part of an exhibition curated by my colleague, whom I respect deeply, Lisa Myers. And, you know, when the work came in, we, as we usually do with the works that are borrowed for exhibition, we do a condition report, which is a way of assessing the health of the object, right? You know, you just kind of note whether there's folds or stains or, you know, imperfections somehow that exist in the surface of the work. And my colleague, Jennifer Bullock, who's our registrar, she was doing the condition reporting and she was trying to find mechanisms to differentiate one sheet of the petition from the other. There's more than 200 sheets that make up this petition. And as she was going through the work, the object, she decided she was going to stop and read one page entirely. And that was when she noticed a name that was familiar to her, the name of Barker Fairley. And Fairley was a name that was familiar to us because he is an artist whose work is represented in our permanent collection. And, you know, just to backtrack a little bit about what this petition is and why this matters, this discovery matters. The petition is an anti-Black, anti-Indigenous document. It was a document that was produced, or a petition that was produced and circulated in the city of Edmonton. 15% of the population signed it. And, you know, the sentiment of the petition is essentially a demand that the federal government step in to prohibit immigration of Black and Indigenous folks coming in from the U.S. into Canada. And if the federal government could not step in and prohibit this immigration, then residents of Edmonton would be forced to take matters into their own hands, which is another way of saying, you know, mob violence, basically, right? And so, you know, we were thinking about all this and thinking, wow, this Barker Fairley signed this vile document. And he also was the champion of the Group of Seven. So he is one of the people who is not in the group that is in the most famous, well-known photograph of the group that circulates constantly, right? So if you go to the Wikipedia entry for the Group of Seven, you will see this picture of the group at the Arts and Letters Club, and you will see Barker Fairley seated there with them. You know, he was a champion of them and, you know, their version of Canadian culture. So, you know, this was a moment, this discovery was a moment when, you know, we knew that the canon could not be separated from these kind of racist sentiments, right? Like they're kind of bound together now through this discovery for us. And so we, that moment, that discovery was really the moment when we knew that we needed to do a more substantial project with Deanna, that we really needed, she needed so much more space to build on this discovery.
there's almost this like physical moment of taking back space by being in the gallery in such a sprawling way.
Well, you know, I don't want to, I try not to be too self-congratulatory for, you know, the institution undertaking a major exhibition like this by a Black artist, because we've never done a show of the scale with this much attention and to the work of a Black artist. And that's not some, I mean, it's not something I'm particularly proud of, but it's a fact of our history, right? And so, you know, having this much space to really expand on all of the different directions that Deanna's research takes seemed in this moment the most respectful approach that we could take, really, right? And I'm so grateful for that, because I mean, I would give her the whole gallery if I could. it would transform what we do, I think, to see all of the space shaped by these narratives. And, you know, that's not to say that the space that it does occupy is insufficient. It's a lot of space and it needs it. And I'm hopeful that when people come to visit, that they'll be able to spend all the time this project needs to really dig in and sit with the narratives that it has at its core.
It's one of those exhibitions that you just kind of keep coming back to and keep learning more.
One of the things that we have learned in the process of like the COVID era, like how to undertake exhibitions in this moment of extreme uncertainty, is to abandon the expectation that things be static. Our shows do not have to be static. So when I was saying before, you know, like one of the beautiful things, really important discoveries about working closely with Deanna is to reckon with the fact that the research is never over, that, you know, it's accumulative. The project never really ends. It's the same thing. Exhibitions can be the same sort of thing, right? So, you know, we have changed the show since it has opened. So it opened back in mid-September. And in that time, we've added new images, new objects. We are amplifying the kind of resources that are available to visitors incrementally. So I'm working with our public programs department to produce a series of videos, interpretive videos that act as little chapters on different themes in the exhibitions. And all of that is kind of rolling out over the lifetime of the exhibition so that hopefully visitors will feel like there's always new ways to engage with it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. One of my questions was around how it was changing, and there's such beauty in, you know, something that feels maybe concealed like an archive changing live over time, even in just a period of a few months. Yeah. So one of the pieces that really stood out to me, or maybe not pieces, but sensory experiences, was, you know, in both rooms at KWAG, there's two audio pieces that ground the space when you enter them. So sort of in the larger room, there's Taps by performed by Charles Ellison. And then in the room to the side, there's Eagle Song by Archer Pichowis.
Pichowis,
thank you. And so, yeah, can you speak to the role that these pieces play in like grounding or building out the space?
I'll start with Charles Ellison and Taps. I mean, Taps is a composition that is often associated with military life and military service. So, you know, we think about Taps being played at military funerals. That's the most common situation in which we'd hear it. And, you know, I think with Deanna, introducing Taps into the space was a way to kind of create a soundtrack you would hear before you saw the work, right? So, you know, oftentimes we will do this with exhibitions that have an audio component. We tend to treat the audio that you hear throughout the space as a kind of soundtrack, right? And it becomes really important to reflect on how it's the mood or the kind of sensibility of that sound then affects or charges the reading of all of the images that you see. And, you know, I think notions of duty and, you know, the exploitations of duty that we can see exist from, you know, the era of slavery through Jim Crow and segregation, different forms of labor succeed slavery but are just as exploitative. And we think about military labor and the idea that a soldier service is never really done until they die. So you can be honorably discharged or dishonorably discharged, but, you know, you're still a soldier really until you leave this this plane, right? And, you know, Deanna wanted to introduce that in a way to think, okay, what are the limits of our duty, actually? Like, what are the limits of a Black body's duty in this kind of space, in this kind of milieu? Is there a way to kind of end this duty sooner? Duty meaning, you know, a duty that you may not have signed up for at all. So there's this kind of way of thinking about an end, a kind of mourning, or a lifting of duty, a lifting of service that is connoted by that soundtrack. And then in the Eastman Gallery with Archer, Deanna is a contemporary of Archer. They're both artists, media art, but they're also contemporaries of one another. And they've collaborated in the past. And so Deanna approached Archer and gave him a sense of what was going to be going on in that room, explained that these are landscapes that are, for all intents and purposes, unpopulated, or at least appear to be so. But, you know, that's not to say that there wasn't life there before. And maybe this kind of erasure is actually a type of violence. And, you know, what might it mean to create a kind of self for the land? And so Archer then created this song. It's an eagle song that he's performing on the drum. And yeah, it acts as a lament for the land, a lament for the kind of loss that the land would have witnessed. And, you know, with Archer's contribution to that space, it really comes together when you're sitting or standing in front of another work. So it's played through the gallery through a parabolic speaker that concentrates the sound in a certain space. And so, yeah, it means that you have to be in a particular spot in the room to really get a full sense of what that sound is. And that space is standing in front of the oral history of Sophia Pooley, who was an enslaved woman that lived in this area.
Both of them are just spectacular sort of works. One may be more familiar to some folks because of the way that we hear some of those taps more often. Mm-hmm. The Eastman Gallery is just such a fascinating contrast, and yeah, just evokes so many of those conversations of loss and the way that we're kind of forced to remember places. And that experience of, like I said, crossing that hallway is very special in my mind.
You know, thinking about transition and movement and passages, right? Like, I mean, there's such a rich kind of intellectual and imaginary territory that in the kind of Black imaginary that overlaps with the transatlantic, right? And, you know, thinking about this middle passage existence and the kind of violence and secrets that would have been told to the water, right, in a way. And, you know, I think about that space as being the Eastman space, Sophia Pooley's narrative in there, right? Her oral history. And Sophia was sold as a child. She was brought to Niagara and sold there when she was 7 years old. And I think about how difficult that must have been for a child, right? To be brought to this strange place and to not know what to expect. And also thinking about, you know, Niagara would have been a spiritual site, right? Like, it was a spiritual for Indigenous communities that were in that area. But also imagine, like, the sound of that place and not being able to see it without all of the hydroelectric infrastructure there, right? Like, you would not have been able to see the falls. You would hear it before you'd see it. And just imagine how frightening that would have been, how all of that awe that would have been associated with that place was also born in the body of that child, right? And so, you know, sometimes when we're curating exhibitions or when I'm curating exhibitions, I have to acknowledge and reflect on those kinds of possibilities and find ways to translate them into the exhibition design somehow. And, you know, if I'm successful, people will feel something along the lines of what you're feeling. So I'm glad to know that it affected you that way.
I think one of my closing questions are around this affect that we feel in our bodies. And if anything, 2020 has really brought a lot of feelings to the surface, whether it's towards the movement for Black lives or whether it's just recognizing that things need to change. There's a shift and it's needed. And I'm really curious, you know, as senior curator at KWAG, how do you see KW and its art scenes playing this role in bridging art and organizing efforts and serving as a venue for these conversations to be built out and a space for knowledge production?
Well, I mean, I think MT Space has been a leader on that front for years, right? And so I think any of us who are trying to do that kind of work need to tip our hat to empty space. But, you know, other things I love about working in this area, and I've worked here now for 15 years, is that I meet these incredibly skilled, incredibly interesting, intellectual, cerebral folks who do not feel like they are suffering by doing their work outside of a cosmopolitan center. Like in some ways, maybe they're thriving as a result of it. And maybe there's that room to kind of experiment and to potentially fail without the scrutiny that comes with big city press and all the other things, right? That enables some really interesting opportunities for growth. I think we still have a lot of growing to do. I mean, we don't have the kind of resources, financial resources in this community to really support the kind of arts and culture community that I know that we need that would reflect the kind of population that we have here too. So I think we're doing what we can with the means that we have, but there's still a lot of room to grow. But, you know, that having been said, I'm also really excited about the next generation of people who are coming up and doing interesting things here, who are trying to change things, who are not operating under this assumption that they need the institution, right? And that's a big change. You know, a generation ago, I think artists would have felt like they really needed to be represented by the institution. I don't believe that's the case anymore. And, you know, I mean, that means as somebody who's working in an institution that I need to think carefully about what I can do to support artists differently. It's not about exposure, right? Or, you know, anointing somebody. It's about like truly supporting what they do. And if that means like being on the ground to do the work with them, then that's what it means, right? I've been here for a while now, so I'm sure there's some things I don't see.
Of course. And I really come back to that terminology of co-conspirator and I really love that.
One other thing I may add is just that a lot of people in the arts community here have communities that are outside of this place, right? Like we are not just about what happens in KW. We are active in communities outside of this geographic region. And, you know, our work is recognized outside of this region. And, you know, I think probably we need to do a little bit better reminding the broader population of that. We don't need scraps, really. Like, we are valued for our work, even if our local community doesn't always see that. We know it.
Yeah, and my final question, you know, this is the largest solo exhibition Quebec mounted in, I think it's 20 years. And what's the piece in this exhibit you keep coming back to, or maybe that really surprised you in a particular way in your curatorial practice?
I mean, I'm inclined to say the petition because we've been living with its story for a while. And, you know, I think bringing it back into the context of this exhibition and is situating it on the same wall and on which it was previously shown, you know, working with the same technician to install the work the second time around to kind of honor Lisa Meyer's role in our relationship with that work. So, you know, that's work that I feel is really stands out for me. But, you know, there are other things that were kind of unexpected. There's a work in the exhibition that is a folly of sorts. It's a false pedestal that was built by our wonderful preparator, Britt Soester. And it was reverse engineered from images found in the archives. It's a pedestal that was modeled on the pedestal that once stood in Victoria Park, on which sat Kaiser Wilhelm's bust. And so Britt built this thing from scratch, and it is such a force in this space, right? Of course, in this moment too, when we're thinking about the reevaluation of monuments, of reflecting on, you know, significance of names and names of our cities and our streets and that sort of thing. We're in like a highly sensitive moment for recreating the kind of history that we want to uphold for the next century, right? And so I felt like that object kind of had an unexpected presence, an unexpected charge in the space.
And I think the scale of it too, it's sort of one of the first things you see when you start to curve into the main area. And it has such presence in that particular way. And what a great way to sort of start that journey off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of makes you think too about, at least it makes me think about the vacant pedestal in Trafalgar Square in the UK that is made available for artist projects, artist commissions, and, you know, what would it mean to have this one vacant pedestal in Kitchener? I sometimes think about that, like, what kind of imagery would we choose to revere? What would be worthy of elevating to that kind of status?
Thank you so much, Crystal, for spending time together today. I really appreciate it. Yeah, this is really wonderful to hear your recounting of some of the behind the scenes of the exhibit, and yeah, just some of the choices that are made in pulling this together, especially as a co-conspirator, as you mentioned. Yeah, just so excited personally to keep visiting, and yes, just genuinely thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for making the time to chat.
In closing off our conversation about the exhibit, I asked Crystal what folks should consider when they visit Black Drones in the Hive. Here's what she had to say.
I would like people to keep an open mind when they come to visit the exhibition and to really think about how they exist within a kind of historical framework. And, you know, I think we're always, as maybe out of human nature, trying to find our place in some kind of constellation of other things, whether it be, you know, historical dates or whether it be people of significance, people in our lives, like, where do we fit into this bigger narrative, this bigger story? And so I'm hoping that visitors will come to the show in a similar kind of frame of mind and to think about what their own kind of historical intersection may be with some of the narratives that they'll encounter in the exhibition, and to not be frightened by that. Like, this, maybe it's worthwhile to be introspective.
Mm-hmm. It's like the tagline of 2020. It's worthwhile to be introspective. It
really is. We have, like, what do you have to lose?
Yeah, no, it's true.
Like, what do we have to lose? I mean, it's definitely a year for something radical, and, you know, maybe renaming everything, doing away with names altogether might be a worthwhile effort, like, or just reimagining what commemoration can look like. And I think that's a good project for 2020.
You've been listening to CKMS News in conversation with Crystal Mari, Senior Curator at the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery. If you missed part one of the conversation, you can check it out at radiowaterloo.ca/news. Black Drones in the Hive is on view at KWAG until February 28th, 2021. You can follow us on Twitter at Radio Waterloo. If you want to get in touch with comments or ideas about stories to cover, email us at news@radiowaterloo.ca.